Good morning, and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible, educational, and fun. I'm Lynn Ware Peek, and today on the program, we speak about physics for those who don't know physics but would like to. John, remember how Freakonomics brought economics to life?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, this is kind of the same thing with physics. Our guest, Helen Chersky, will do that in her new book, Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life.
Fun book.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good morning, Lynn. I'm John Wells, and our second guest is Sarah George. She's the executive director of the Natural History Museum of Utah. She joins us to talk about an exhibit that opened earlier this month and will remain open through Labor Day. It's called Nature's Ultimate Machines. Imagine an animal's jaw that can crush over 8,000 pounds or ears that act as an air conditioner and other marvels of natural engineering.
These two guests, when we return, it's Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We proudly support KPCW and many other local nonprofits. We have been supporting the local community and providing real estate services since 1976. All current and active listings can be found on our website at bhhsutah.com.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, happy to keep KPCW Radio and their staff running smoothly. We provide sales and maintenance on all computer systems and can guide our customers about cloud solutions for their businesses or personal computer needs. More info available at 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peek. In an age of string theory, fluid dynamics, and biophysics, it can seem as if the science world is only for specialists and academics. Not so, insists our guest Helen Chersky. She delivers everyday physics to us in a fun, palatable way that we can understand and in a way that will sharpen our curiosity about physics no matter who we are. Helen will take us through the physics for an example of popcorn in hot oil, or how a bottle of ketchup demonstrates laws of physics like gravity to the equilibrium to the nature of time. She joins us from her home in London. Helen Chersky, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Helen, the one thing I have to say from the beginning is that when I was reading the book, it was written with such enthusiasm. You really love this, don't you?
I am quite enthusiastic in life, and I just like playing with things. And so, you know, I am very happy to share this idea of playing with the world. And I think there's this perception that playing is what the children do. But actually, we're all learning all the time. And I think that not being afraid to be enthusiastic about it is a good thing, because you're only going to learn more.
Absolutely. So why don't we start from the beginning? Tell us why you wrote this book, why you wanted to get this to us.
I'm a physicist. I'm an academic physicist here at University College London, and I have, you know, I've studied physics for years, and I write papers on it and all that kind of stuff. And I realized that nobody else, you know, lots of people, when they talk about physics, they talk about cosmology and quantum mechanics, and they talk about all these weird, distant things, which are not how I see physics. And the thing is that we live in a world which is, our everyday experience is not generally quantum mechanics or the Big Bang. It's about how things fall or spin or stick to stuff. And this is all physics. And it is just as interesting, if not more so, because it allows all those little things that we see in the everyday world. There's lots of interesting things out there that we're still learning about. And so I wrote the book because I thought no one is playing with the world, and everyone should be playing with the world. And the thing is that often people feel that science is somebody else's problem. You know, it's difficult. It's, like you said at the start, it's just somewhere else. But actually, we all need an understanding of the world, and we can learn the basic things from these everyday bits and pieces. You know, the laws of physics are the same. The law of physics that makes a piece of toast fall off a table is the same law of physics, you know, gravity, that controls how spaceships move through the, you know, fall back into our atmosphere after being in orbit. And so the same physics in the basic stuff lets you get at the physics in the big important things. And no one seems to be saying that. So I thought I'd say it.
And I'm so glad you did, Helen. You know, I have to just say, a couple weeks ago when SpaceX's Falcon Heavy was launched, and it wasn't so much the launch that blew my mind, but it was those boosters returning to their target. And when they came, you know, catapulting through the sky and then slowing down and then landing with perfect precision, my first thought was, why didn't I take more physics? Well, why didn't I take any physics, actually, you know, in high school or college? And it made me feel like even there was even a greater divide by from what I knew and from what, you know, a physicist that works for SpaceX knows. And that was very troubling for me. And so I'm really happy that you come out with a book like Storm in a Teacup. So maybe you could take an everyday instance or circumstance that could parallel, and part of it is gravity, but part of it are, you know, well, jet propulsion, I suppose, you know, something, a parallel in your book that might explain what happened with those rocket boosters to someone like me.
Well, those rocket boosters were extremely impressive, just because of the control. I mean, the thing is that what they did was they took all these little bits of physics that I wrote about, and they wove them together to make this thing happen. And that was a really impressive thing. I think probably the So there's loads of little bits of physics in that. Things falling down is quite interesting because there's this thing that no one mentions. When you weigh out, let's go to cooking in the kitchen, right? You know, you weigh out some flour or some sugar. So we have scales in the UK. I know you use cups more often on your side of the Atlantic. But, you know, if you're weighing some ingredients, the only reason your scales work is because there's a planet underneath you. And it's always pulling things downwards. And your scales would not work if you weren't sitting on the planet. And so gravity is probably the place to start with the Falcon Heavy thing because, you know, we just sort of assume we know which way down is because it's the way things fall. But really, all that's happening is that we're being pulled towards the Earth and the Earth is being pulled towards us. And the scales just sit in between the two, measuring the squeeze of those two things being pulled towards each other. And it's exactly the same with the Falcon Heavy, you know, that the greatest problem with getting into low Earth orbit is using gravity, you know, getting away, going against this force, going against the pull towards the planet to get yourself into orbit. And actually, the interesting thing about satellites in orbit is that they don't escape gravity, right? If you go up to where the International Space Station is, it hasn't actually escaped gravity. There's almost as much gravity up there as there is down here, pulling it towards the center of the Earth. The way they get around it is they go sideways so quickly that as they fall, the curve of the Earth falls away underneath them, and that's why things can orbit. And so this idea that there is, I'm going through a lot of different things here, but in our everyday lives, we are pulled towards the planet underneath us. And that is both a nuisance and a benefit for anything in low Earth orbit. You can use it. Once you know about it, you can use it so that you don't, you know, if you're in orbit, you're not getting any further from the Earth. If you get it just right, you can use gravity to go round and round in a way that you couldn't if gravity wasn't there.
That's great. So bringing it back to something more simplistic that you find in your everyday life, and this is kind of coming away from gravity, but it was something that kind of cracked me up in your introduction. And it illuminates why we just take things for granted or we don't think about the science of them. But someone like you does. And this is why it's so delightful. You talk about this blueberry jam that you made.
Oh, yeah.
And it turned out pink, bright fuchsia pink, you say. And you know, just something like that happening, it makes someone like you stop and say, okay, why is this? And this is, I think, part of why you wrote the book.
Well, the thing about the blueberry jam, so the interesting thing about all these things is that this is about patterns. So physics isn't about a list of facts to learn. It's about there are patterns in the way the world works. And if you see the pattern in one place, it then applies in lots of other places. You've got yourself a tool. And the thing about the blueberry jam is that, so this is when I was living in Rhode Island and I wanted to make blueberry jam. And I spotted something, like you said, I wanted to make blueberry jam because I thought that'd be cool. And it came out bright pink. And the thing is that that kind of sat with me. It, you know, it sort of sat there as this, I'm slightly frustrated by this. I haven't, you know, I haven't got time to really look into it, but it's kind of sitting there. And it was 6 months later that another little everyday thing came along. And when I realized the explanation for the second thing, I could also explain the jam. And so the game in all this is that you never stop learning, right? You don't always have time. You know, adults, questions pop into your head. As an adult, you tend to sort of go, oh, I haven't got time to think about that, or I don't know how to think about that. And you just kind of squash it, push it away. So, you don't do anything with it. But if you hold on to those questions, sometimes you can't answer them straight away. But then later on, you see another piece of the same pattern and you build up this picture. And so you're always learning. And this is why the physics of the everyday world continues to be fun for me. You know, I've passed all my exams in physics, but I'm still seeing new ways that these patterns work in the world. And the blueberry jam was just a lovely, you know, it really was 6 months. And then when the penny dropped, it was so obvious and so beautiful. And you know what? I feel like, I always hit this thing where I'm doing these interviews and I want to explain it, but the other part of me wants not to explain it because it's so much more fun when people do the experiment for themselves, like try it out and then play with it, see if they can work out why it happens.
Oh, wait, so you're not going to tell us the second part of when the penny dropped? That's well, give us the experiment then that we need to do.
Here's the experiment that you need to do, and it's actually not with blueberries. Well, you can do it. You can do it with blueberries. It works better with red cabbage. And if you boil red cabbage in some water, and this isn't exactly, it was flowers in the book, but red cabbage is easier to get hold of than the right kind of flowers. You boil the red cabbage and the water goes red. And the thing is, then what you have to do is go around and just put little drips of that red liquid on different things and watch what happens. And it won't be damaging or dangerous. But it's worth, that's the way in. It's that something happens to that red cabbage water when you put it on different things, and you can try things in your kitchen. So, for example, milk and orange juice and laundry powder, you know, you can try those things. And you'll see something, and it's the key to the blueberry jam puzzle. So everything else in the interview, I promise I'll explain, but I think that one, I encourage your listeners next time they've got some red cabbage to try that one out, because it is really cool when you see how it works.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Helen Chersky, who has written Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. John Gribben from the Wall Street Journal stated, this is an excellent book, an ideal gift for any scientifically inquisitive person, including children or adults who retain a child's sense of wonder. I'm going to go back to Lynn's Falcon Heavy. When it jettisoned the two side boosters and the main rocket was going as the boosters were leaving the configuration, there was a cowling or a cover over the engine of the main main rocket that was still firing. And that cowling was a bright red. And now I know, after reading your book, that any material that gets to 1,800 degrees will turn a bright red. And that's how we know that stars, how old they may be or how hot they may be. And that's how we know our toaster is working. So it's the everyday toaster, and it's star systems that we can tell the temperature. And also I'll mention there were little pieces of yellow in that red. And I know from reading your book that those pieces of yellow were heated to about 4,900 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's true with all materials, isn't it, Helen?
Yeah, that's right. So it's one of those. It's a very fundamental law of physics, and yet you do see it in your toaster and when you put your broiler on, that kind of thing. That things glow, and actually we're glowing too. It's just that we can't see the colours that we're glowing in. So every single object that has a temperature is giving away some light, and the colour of that light depends in a very specific way on the temperature. So when you, you switch on like a hob or something that's going to heat up or your grill element, you'll see, first of all, it goes dull red. And then as it gets hotter, the red gets brighter and brighter, and then it goes yellowish. And if you're, I don't think you should do this with your grill, but if you can keep going up the temperature scale, it will eventually go bluish and white, and the color changes. And by looking at the colour, you can measure the temperature exactly. And it's because we're all giving off heat. And the hotter we are, the shorter the wavelengths of light that we give out. And so in the case of us, human beings, we've got a body temperature of around, oh, well, we would say 37 degrees centigrade, but in 90-something Fahrenheit.
Yeah, 97, I think.
Yeah, thank you. So we are also glowing like light bulbs, except we're glowing in the infrared, which is beyond the red end of the rainbow. And that's how thermal cameras work. If you ever see those thermal images, they can see the light that we can't. They can see us glowing, even though we can't. And we have to give away that energy because of our temperature. And so you can directly see the temperature of something as long as you can see the colors that go along with that temperature. So whenever you see a grill element or a hot coal or something that is one exact shade of red, everything that you see that is that exact shade of red is the exact same temperature because the laws of physics say that must be the case.
Yeah. Well, this will give you a glimpse into my mind. We have an expression in the United States, and you may have this in the UK, and of course you spent some time in this country, in the States. One of the sayings is, seeing is believing. Another saying is, I saw it with my own eyes. But we don't see that much. I mean, you think about the electromagnetic spectrum. Someone once told me, you know, with radio waves, X-rays, gamma rays, and of course that little sliver of a spectrum where our eyes are able to actually see things, that if the electromagnetic spectrum was sprawled out between the East Coast and the West Coast of the United States, the little area that we see, that little spectrum, would be like a foot or two long or something. And then you get into gravity, which you talk about in the book, and how different things, and Lynn and I sitting across from each other, how our gravitational pull, the weak force, how we're interacting with each other. It's just bizarre. There's so much we don't see. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, so the world is flooded with information of various types. You know, there's sound waves and there's light waves and there's gravity and there's these, you know, different types of things whooshing past us or, you know, existing in the space where we exist, you know, gases and things like that. And our senses only allow us to tap into quite a narrow part of that. And it's even better than that because if you think about, you know, you've got a body, if you're a human, you're probably nearly 2 meters tall, that kind of size. But the only part of you that can detect light is the pupil of your eye. It's this tiny little hole in the front of your eye. And so there's all this light whooshing past you in all these different directions, and only the tiny part of it that goes in through your pupil will be detected. And only the tiny part of the spectrum, the visible light that we can see, will actually go in and be detected. And so our senses are very clever. They're going on a tiny bit of information to build up a picture of the world around us. And actually, the amazing thing about light spectrum that you mentioned is that, you know, so if you imagine a wave, it goes up and then down and then up again, and we measure waves in the distance between the two ups, between the two hills, if you like, across the valley. And so you can have wavelengths of light that go from tiny, you know, billionths of a meter all the way up to many, many hundreds of meters. And in the middle of that is the visible spectrum. And the difference, you imagine looking at a rainbow and you're looking across from red all the way to violet. The difference in the wavelength between the red and the violet is less than times two. So if you can imagine a wave and then you imagine a wave twice as long and make that one a bit shorter, that difference, that tiny difference between a wave that is this big and almost twice as big, all of the color we see in the world is squeezed into that range. And then there's all these other colors outside it that we can't see. So our sense, and it's very interesting when you look at animals, for example, because they are also in the world and they've got all this information flowing past them. And they quite often, in order to survive, will detect different parts of it. So there are some snakes that can directly detect infrared, for example. There are birds that can see ultraviolet light beyond the violet end of the spectrum. So they're tapping into the information that they need. You know, elephants can hear far lower notes than we can. And so once you learn all of that, it kind of becomes frustrating because you know, suddenly, you know, we think of ourselves that we've got these great senses and we can see the world and hear the world. And then actually you're kind of put back in your place and there's all this stuff that you can't see as a human. But technology is allowing us to see it. And we can still see its influence in the world. You know, even though we can't see infrared, if we put our hand in front of a hot thing, we can feel the infrared light being absorbed by our hand. So we can sort of tell it's there if you know where to look. So you build up this picture of the world with all these patterns in it, and then you start to be able to explain things. Because it's not just about knowing the fact. The important thing is that understanding the framework for how the world works allows you to ask the right questions. Because you're never going to know all the answers. But the time you do well is if you know which questions to ask. And that's why this toolbox is useful. Sometimes you can explain things for yourself, but sometimes you can say, you know what, I know the framework and this is the thing that I don't know and now I know to ask. And so it's that allowing people to have the ability to do things for themselves that's really important about all this.
Our guest is Helen Chersky. Her book is Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. And Helen, I just have to tell you that John has been across the board from me, and I see him mouthing, I'm reading his lips. He keeps saying things like, I love this stuff. I love this stuff. This is so cool. I think you have a fan. And
I'm humbled. I'm humbled at my little range of perception, but I do love this stuff.
But we're all learning. That's the important bit, right? Even if you don't know very much, you can always learn a little bit more.
So one of the, yes, absolutely. One of the great things you do in your book is take us into an English pub on a lazy Sunday at lunchtime, of course, a place that we all ought to want to be. And you start talking about viscosity and xanthan gum and, oh, gravity and ketchup. And this is a great one. I knew when my kids had a good physics teacher in high school that when they said to me at our version of an English pub, which is Devanza's just down the street here in Park City, they said, hey, do you know why the ketchup doesn't come out? So why don't you take us through that one?
So the ketchup is one of these great things which everyone has sort of seen. But what's very sad is that this is something that applies to glass ketchup bottles. And some spoil sport in food manufacturing has started making plastic squeezy bottles.
That's
which
right.
Takes all the fun out of it. So imagine yourself back with a glass bottle of ketchup. And there was this sight that used to be very common before the boring squeezy bottles came along, which was that you would see someone with a bowl of fries and a bottle of ketchup, and they would be shaking the bottle, and nothing would come out of the bottle. And they would get very frustrated, and just as they're about to give up, half the bottle comes out all at once, all over their fries. And it's very frustrating unless you like ketchup a lot. And the thing is that there's a reason ketchup does that. It's a really interesting liquid. And the reason it's interesting is because it's viscous. You know, ketchup, if it's just sitting there in a kind of splodge, is quite thick. And so you can imagine it would stay in the bottle. But ketchup does something very interesting, which is that it doesn't really move, it just sits there. But if you can force it to move, it suddenly becomes less viscous, it becomes thinner, and so it flows much more easily. So the thing with ketchup is that it doesn't move, but once it starts to go, it all goes at once. And it's something called, it's got a name in physics, it's called a non-Newtonian fluid. And in this case, that's because the viscosity of the ketchup depends on how quickly you're moving it. So now that's really useful for ketchup because it means it stays in the bottle and it stays on your chip. Imagine if it poured out of the bottle easily because it was thin and then you dipped a chip in it and all the ketchup just ran off, right?
That'd be horrible.
You want to sort of blob on your fries, sorry. Speaking
that's okay.
English. there is a solution to the problem, right? What you want to do is to get just a little bit of the ketchup moving, not the whole bottle, but just a little bit. And so the solution to the problem, instead of shaking the whole bottle and trying to turn the whole thing thin enough to come out of the bottle, what you do is you hold it at an angle and you tap the neck. Because what that does is it shunts just the ketchup in the neck. So that's the only bit that gets moving and that's the only bit that gets thinner and flows out. But everything in the bulk of the bottle stays put because it's not being asked to move. So this is a fun thing, and you know there's lots of other fluids that behave in the same way. But this is a non-Newtonian fluid, which is what this is called. It's the same thing that allows a snail to move without ever taking the bottom of its foot off the ground. Because the problem if you're a snail, right, you know, you've got one foot and you want to move, but it's not like you can kind of take steps like a person, right? Because that, you know, how do you slide? How does some bits of a snail slide without all of it sliding? And the way a snail solves this problem is by having mucus that is basically like the ketchup. And so what a snail does is down the outsides of its foot, it does one thing, and then down the middle, all the way down the middle of the foot, it does something else. So what it does is all the outsides basically don't move very much. So they're like the ketchup that's not moving, the mucus is nice and thick. And then down the middle of the snail, they shove that bit forward. So it suddenly becomes less viscous and thin, and it moves very quickly. So they can shove the middle bit forward by doing it quickly. And then what they do is they kind of stick that middle bit in place by not moving it very much. And all the rest of the snail can move to catch up. So they can control which bit of their foot is sticking to the surface by controlling how fast they're moving the muscle at that point. And that is why snails can slime all over things without, you know, lifting off, like a caterpillar kind of lifts off and that lets it move forward. But the snails have this mucus. And so these little things, you know, once you see them, and the idea of a snail, the scientists that did this, I think they're in California, they put snails on top of glass, you know, like window panes, and looked at them from underneath to look where they were moving. And it must have been a very satisfying experiment to do. So there's all these little things, like all those little questions you don't ask, like how can a snail move forward? Like a five-year-old would ask that question, but an adult would sort of go, oh, no, well, I'm too old to ask that question. Rubbish. It's a brilliant question, and it's got a brilliant answer.
I never knew that about snails. I, of course, have seen the snail trails, but I thought it was just they left it because they could, and they were just, you know, because they were so slow and don't do a lot otherwise. One thing they could do is leave a snail trail. But I love it. Of course, now when the next time I see a snail, and of course, for us, it usually means going to the Pacific Northwest. We don't have a lot of snails here in the desert. But I'll think about that. And what a wonderful thing to watch it mosey across a pane of glass.
You've got something else there in the desert, though, which is scorpions.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Scorpions do something very clever with light, which is that they fluoresce, which means if you go out into the desert with a UV light, you know, a dark light, the scorpions will glow up bright blue. In fact, I've got a picture of one on my office wall, and all my academic colleagues think I made it up. but they do. Scorpions, you know, you may have seen this, they glow this eerie blue. And what they're doing is they're taking the ultraviolet light that we can't see, and they're turning it into light that we can see. And it's the same way that high-vis jackets work. So, you know, those bright kind of fluorescent yellow things, they take light in the ultraviolet that we can't see, and they turn it into light that we can see, which is why it looks like they're glowing. So you might not have snails in the desert, but you can learn something from your scorpions.
I love that.
I do too. So, Helen, you're a very curious person. If there was one question out there in the world of physics that you would like to have answered that has not been answered yet, what would it be?
Oh, that's hard.
You have a lot of questions, don't you?
Yeah, I have got a lot of questions, and they come in different scales. You know, there's like the big questions.
This has like to be a big one.
The big physics questions are things like, what is dark matter? But they're not much fun down here on Earth. You know, so one thing that would be interesting, so there is a small little problem that people haven't quite solved yet, and I was writing about it just the other day, which is why I'm thinking about it, and it's knuckle cracking. So you know, some people can do that thing where they kind of pull on their finger and it makes this little snap sound.
Yeah.
So there's still papers being written on that. We've not quite solved the problem. So people have got a long way with that. There's a basically what happens when you pull on your joint, a little bubble pops into your joint, and it's the sound of it, the sudden sound of it being formed, that is that snap. But there's still some debate about exactly what generates the sound and why it's so loud, because if someone snaps their knuckle, you know, you can hear it on the other side of the room. And so those are the little things that fascinate me, is that we've sort of got some way with that puzzle. There's some papers last year even that show fingers in an MRI scanner and show this little bubble being produced, but they've not quite solved the problem. So today my question is, exactly how does that process work, and how is it so loud?
I love that.
I was thinking there'd be something a little heavier than that. So like,
well,
a
you know,
big,
you said not the heavy stuff.
Oh. I like that.
Heavy questions is come maybe to do with, let's think of a middling question.
So don't. So it can't be dark energy.
No, because those are the big questions. Those are not the ones we can play with.
Yeah.
It would be probably something about the ocean. So I study the ocean quite a lot, and I'm interested in how light and sound travel through the ocean, and what's generating sounds in the ocean. So there might be something like that, because there's some sounds we can't quite explain from the ocean that might be due to cracking glasses and things we don't quite know. So maybe understanding the sounds of the ocean better. Is that a better middle-sized question?
That's a middle-sized question. We appreciate it. We're speaking with Helen Chersky. We want to thank you so much for joining us this morning. She has written Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. And we thank you for being with us.
It's a great book.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, we hope to have you back on. How's that sound?
Very happy to be back, yeah.
Okay, great. Thanks. Have a great day.
Goodbye.
Bye.
And we'll be back after this. And, you know, it's actually a great segue into our next guest, who is Sarah George, who's the executive director of the Natural History Museum of Utah. But
yeah.
Their current exhibit, which runs through Labor Day, which I spoke to her about. Well, I think you were out skiing powder or something like that. was all of these kind of hands-on experiments that show you why we ought to be asking those questions that as adults we often say, oh, well, that's a child's question.
Right.
But so it's great. Stay with us. We'll be back with that interview when we return.
Park City Restore is grateful for the many hands that have made it successful. Your gift of time means more affordable housing services are available locally through Habitat for Humanity. Plus, volunteering at the Restore gives you a first look at the amazing treasures donated for resale. Learn how you can get involved at habitat-utah.org. Click on the big yellow volunteer button. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. We were just speaking with Helen Chersky. And if you want to look her up, because she's fascinating, her last name is spelled C-Z-E-R-S-K-I, Chersky. Her book, Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. And now we'll be broadcasting a taped interview that I did with Sarah George from the Natural History Museum of Utah, which underwrites this program. And, oh, it wasn't on a day. I remember now. It wasn't on a day you were skiing powder. Remember last week when you had that horrible laryngitis?
Yes.
And we were going to tape this interview, and you could barely speak. So you ran the board. I did the interview, and it was great. So we're looking forward to hearing this again. It's about an exhibit at the Natural History Museum of Utah called Nature's Ultimate Machines, and it demonstrates how plants and animals have developed specialized ways of adapting to the world, such as jaws that crush over 8,000 pounds, ears that act as an air conditioner, veins that can pump to crazy heights. Imagine the vein going up the neck of a giraffe. How does it pump that blood up there? Just a few marvels of natural engineering. Nature's Ultimate Machines exhibits more than 130 specimens, replicas, videos, interactive displays, and biomimicry innovations to illustrate the great diversity of biological designs. Sarah George, again, is the museum's executive director, and here is that interview. Welcome, Sarah George, to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
So as the executive director of the Natural History Museum of Utah, what kinds of wonderful things do you pack your days with?
This is always a busy place. Of course, we have school groups, we have programs, we have festivals, we have our great exhibits, and we also have a special exhibition gallery that changes about twice a year.
And that is what Nature's Ultimate Machines is, one of these exhibitions that I believe began last weekend and will run for 6 months or so?
Actually, through Labor Day.
So it must be quite an impactful exhibition.
Well, it's a great exhibit. It actually really fits our goal of trying to illuminate nature. And it's an opportunity for people to find answers to a lot of their curious questions. How does a giraffe pump blood all the way up to its brain, up that long neck? How do turtle shells, how much weight can they handle? just many, many questions as we study nature. It's a marvelous thing. Animals and plants have developed incredible adaptations, and this exhibit is a great way to dig into those, to find out how they work, why they are the way they are, and to learn how humans have used these adaptations as models for developing new engineering ideas.
Wow. So this is kind of a how things work, I think, of that book, the way things work,
yes,
but for nature, and also in sort of 3D and hands-on. Do we have hands-on exhibits as well?
Lots of hands-on. There are things you can do. There's a great film, amazing films of things that happen so fast you don't even know they've happened with your naked eye. But they've slowed them down to really analyze how animals work. There are electronic games. You can build a better eye electronically. You can try to pump the blood up the giraffe's neck. And I have not yet been able to do that. But I've watched other people do it successfully.
Does it take what? More muscles? More?
A lot of muscles. Oh. It really does. It's so interesting. Giraffes actually have the same number of neck vertebrae that we do, but they're very elongated.
Right.
And it takes incredible blood pressure to get the blood all the way up to the brain. And so another question, of course, is why don't they have, how do they survive with such high blood pressure? And it has to do with structure and anatomy.
Wow. So not only do you explore how animals slither and crawl and gallop and swim and jump, but you also go into a lot of technological breakthroughs.
Yeah.
And again, this is funny. You talk about Velcro, and I didn't know that Velcro was inspired by nature's ingenuity.
It was. A scientist, I believe in Europe, was trying to comb burrs out of his dog's fur. And he was amazed at how well they adhered to his dog. So he dissected them and looked at the little hooks that were at the ends of each spine coming off the seed pod. Mm-hmm. And he said, wow, that works. And sure enough, if you look closely at Velcro, you have kind of fuzzy, a furry side. And then the other side is these little plastic hooks that catch into it. And when you peel the Velcro back, he realized he could peel the burrs out rather than pulling them out. And that's, of course, how you separate the two sides of Velcro.
That is amazing. And this sort of hinges on why we want to go and visit the Natural History Museum of Utah and why we want to see exhibits like this. And it has to do with the fact that my dog gets burrs all the time, and I have,
right.
And I am very well aware of the ingenuity of Velcro, but I have never connected the two. And perhaps if we bring our children to exhibits like this, and if we expose ourselves to them, it opens our minds and enables us to look more through the lens of science and nature and the ingenuity that kind of brings the two together. I think this is very valuable.
Absolutely. And the University of Utah, of course, has an incredible number of programs that are applying ideas like this. For example, we have a graduate student here who is trying to design a better helmet to prevent concussions, and she's looked a lot at woodpeckers, because if you think about it, woodpeckers are banging their heads on trees to try to get through the bark and into get grubs and worms deep inside the tree. And they, you know, they don't have problems with concussions. Well, how the heck does that work? So she's been studying bird woodpecker skull anatomy and trying to adapt some of the things she's learned from that in designing new helmets.
Wow, that's fascinating. You know, just this morning I was looking at my little dog, a three-year-old dog, who is a klutz, and he's always running his head into things. And I have often wondered if he is constructed somehow differently, because if I ran into things as often as he does with my skull, I would have been inflicted with many, many concussions. So again, you know, the how amazing nature is.
It's remarkable.
Go ahead.
The environment that animals have evolved into over millions and millions of years, well, really billions of years, it has really put enormous pressure on organisms to change over time. You come up with the genetic variability, and then the environmental pressures will select characteristics that help the descendants of those animals survive better. Mm-hmm. And so it's a great example of evolution in action. And again, you know, there's so much we can learn from it. There's a fantastic robot that is the only robot with knees. They were able to get to, to move, and they did it by constructing the legs with giant rubber bands that act like tendons do in our legs. So you can see that there.
Wow.
We all know that some birds sort of flap really hard and don't fly very far, and other birds don't flap very hard and fly great distances. And why is that? It has to do with the shape of the wing. And there's actually an interactive where you can sit in a chair and flap one of the two different shapes of wings and see if you go fast or slow. So it's again, it's connecting observations to real-life adaptations.
Right. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, I'm speaking with Sarah George. She's the executive director of the Natural History Museum of Utah, about the museum's new exhibit that just was kicked off last weekend, Nature's Ultimate Machines, and it will be on exhibit until Labor Day. Wanted to ask you, before we talk a little bit more about the specifics of the exhibit, you are connected to, you are located at the Rio Tinto Center, and perhaps this is my perspective being up here in Park City. I think that's the first time I've seen the connection between the Natural History Museum of Utah and mentioning that it's at the Rio Tinto Center. Can you explain the relationship?
Right, yeah. So the name of the building is the Rio Tinto Center. So the museum, the institution, we are the State Museum of Natural History, so we hold the state's collections, many of which are on display in our permanent galleries. And then the building itself, the biggest single private funder was Rio Tinto, the Kennecott copper mine. Mm-hmm. And so the building is named for them.
Okay, that makes sense. I've always thought of it as just this gorgeous building that is the Natural History Museum of Utah. So now I'll...
And that would be accurate as well.
Yeah. So I love, again, how you talked about some of the University of Utah bioengineering PhD students doing the research. You mentioned the one about concussions and woodpeckers. What else are our young students who may be interested in a career in bioengineering? What are they able to see when they come? You've got a couple of other research projects going on, one about how birds climb.
Yes, well... So one of the big questions in studying the evolution of flight is, did feathers come first? Did they glide before they fly? I mean, what was the process for developing flight? And in the case of birds, we do know that, in fact, their ancestors did have feathers before they flew. And there's some great dinosaur evidence coming out of China, mostly, that shows feather structures. And some out of Germany. You can think of Archaeopteryx. And Archaeopteryx is really, it's the first known bird that did fly. Hmm. But if you look at just the skeleton without the feathers, you wouldn't know that it was a bird and not a dinosaur. What this student is studying is we believe that the ancestors of birds glided, but how did they get high up in trees when they had their front limbs covered with feathers and they didn't really have good fingers for climbing? Mm-hmm. So they really only had two limbs. And so she is studying how, in fact, birds move up through trees. And that can, you know, we walk on our hind legs, right? We don't use our front legs. So what kind of applications does that have in helping hind limbs operate better?
That's great. So in addition to some of these bioengineering research projects, the exhibit is divided and well organized, I might add, into seven sections. So you've talked about some of them, you know, the giraffe, that's sort of the going with the flow, the pumps and pipes section. There is, this one's fascinating, staying in one piece, structures and materials, how plants and animals manage to stay in one piece. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so, you know, we've live in a world with gravity, and for organisms that are underwater, they're living with even more crushing gravity, right? And so what are some of the structures that we have evolved to protect ourselves from that? So if you think about eggs, an egg on end can bear pounds and pounds of weight, and it's because the pressure it spreads out over a domed surface, whereas if you put pressure on a flat surface, it'll crack and break. Mm-hmm. So the round shape of an egg or the domed shape of a turtle shell can bear far more weight than if the shells were flat. Leaves, for example, how is it that you can have a big windstorm come through in the summer and all the deciduous trees don't lose their leaves? And it has to do with the way the attachments are designed and how leaves are able to bend with wind pressure. So and there are lots of different examples through this section of the exhibition that show the ingenious adaptations that have evolved over time. And, you know, some of the other sections you mentioned, pumps and pipes, how do we circulate blood? And in invertebrate animals, where they have a hard shell, their skeleton's on the outside, right?
Right.
So how do they get oxygen inside when they don't breathe? And they have these ingenious vessels that poke through the shell, the exterior shell, and they actually, the vessels themselves expand and contract and pull oxygen in and push carbon dioxide back out. So it's, you know, there's not one plan fits all, and this exhibit gives you a sense of the incredible breadth of adaptation that we have, that animals and plants have evolved.
Right. Wonderful. Well, I've always observed my husband eating, and I think his jaws become unhinged at the back of his mouth for the amount of food he can put in. But this is, you know, he is nothing like the, you know, the snake that can can swallow a live rabbit whole.
Right.
And so this is another one of the sections, and my husband's going to kill me for if he hears this, but it's true. But anyway, grabbing a bite is the section, jaws and claws, and how do animals do it?
And there's a great demonstration of a fossil fish that people were wondering how much pressure could those jaws put on their prey. And these guys built a metal replica of this fossil and then attached levers and chomped on various things. And man, just based on the anatomy that we know from this multi-million-year-old fish, they could bite steel.
Wow.
And jaws also, especially for organisms that live under the water, if you have jaws that can open quickly, they actually suck the prey in. So they don't have to chase it. They just develop a vacuum and pull their prey in before they eat it. So jaws have multiple uses.
Wow. That's wonderful. Well, all this and much, much more at the Natural History Museum of Utah. Sarah George is the executive director of the museum, and she joins me to talk about Nature's Ultimate Machines, the exhibit that recently opened and will be at the museum through Labor Day. And Sarah, any final words about to lure people to come?
Yeah, you know, we always like the real thing, and this exhibit is chock full of specimens. It was organized by the Field Museum in Chicago, and they have extraordinary collections. So there are hundreds of plants and animals, in addition to all the interactives that you can actually see in the exhibit.
Wonderful. And one last mention, all of the exhibit is in both English and Spanish, which is wonderful.
That's correct. Bilingual.
Excellent. Sarah George, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Lynn.
All right. Take care.
Uh-huh.
Again, that exhibit will be running through Labor Day at the Natural History Museum of Utah. And we have just a moment, John.
Next week, pledge drive, and we're really excited about it. You know, the money raised by our pledge drives covers 20% of the operating budget, and this year our goal is $125,000. Our mission to serve Summit and Wasatch counties with the local news, information, entertainment, emergency alerts, all sorts of stuff. We hope you'll support us.
That's right. And if you think about it, many of Park City area nonprofits would have to spend a whole heck of a lot more on their marketing efforts were it not for KPCW. We give them lots of airtime, and this is another reason that you should contribute to KPCW during next week's pledge drive. It's Monday through Thursday, and we want to thank our underwriters, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Nexus IT, Habitat for Humanity Restore, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
It's KPCW.